Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Maron to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Maron at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to DragonCast, home of House of the Dragon. Gather your small council, send out your ravens, and call in your bannermen. I'm Hand of the King, Jaime East, here to guide you through the highly anticipated return to Westeros. Yes, hello, hello, House of the Dragon. The long-awaited successor series to Game of Thrones is now just only a matter of days or a week away. Joining me today to discuss all things House of the Dragon and the state of the realm since we last spent any time over there are Elio and Linda from Westeros.org. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi there.
And journalist Chris Mandel. Chris, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Pleasure. Right, let's do this. Goodness gracious me, I did not expect to be back here in the kind of vague kind of Thronecast-y universe so soon. 2019 said goodbye to the studio, to Sky, to HBO, to the Night King, to we left Bran kind of like becoming the Bran the Wise and all the things that went. Jon's rambling around in the mountains somewhere. And I thought that was it. And then, of course, the deluge of prequel rumours started to hit probably about about 6 months after Game of Thrones, and there were talks of 5 pilots being made, 10 pilots being made, and in the end there was a pilot that was made that didn't go any further, and all of the interest and all of the money and all of the resource and all of the might of George R. Martin and everything got thrown into what we now know as House of the Dragon. And if you're new to me, I'm Jaime East. I am the co-presenter of Thronecast on Sky Atlantic. Have been for, I think, maybe about 5 seasons. I can't remember. Four or five seasons spent getting ingrained in the universe of HBO and Sky Atlantic and Belfast and meeting all the cast and the crew and the people that made the swords. So I am absolutely delighted that they decided to do this again. Because, hey, there's nothing I love more than talking about Game of Thrones. And joining me each week is going to be hopefully some cast members, some behind-the-scenes people, you never know, maybe a showrunner or two. But every single week, rain or shine, winter or summer, fire or ice, will be Chris Mandel. Chris, we've known each other for a while now, right?
Yeah, we've known each other for a long time, through thick and thin. Yeah, it's really exciting to be back talking about House of the Dragon with you and going back to Westeros once again.
So you're a journalist, and you're, you know, we've kind of bonded over kind of quality dramas, let's say. You've been on the previously on podcast when we did Succession.
Yeah.
And I would rather have no one else as my I'm Hand of the King to Sue Perkins, and you're my Hand of the King. How's that? I don't know what that.
Yeah, the hand's hand, the hand's is hand. The sort of official title I've given myself. Well, the pinky finger on the hand.
The pinky finger on the king. Fine. Okay. You like the pod, you like a mini Podrick.
Yeah, thank you.
And whenever Thronecast was stuck or were unsure of anything or were terrified of upsetting the book people, as we used to call them in TV land. There were only two people that we knew who to call, Elio and Linda from Westeros.org. How are you guys?
Well, great. And it is great to be back. It's a little surreal in some way, as you said, that this was still going to continue and that it was going to be such a big production again. So it's a really interesting position to be in, and great to have a chance to get into this new show.
And for those listening or watching on YouTube that don't know what you do, or they won't know what I do or anything like that, give us a sense of how you are so ingrained into the Game of Thrones universe. You are the people that George R. Martin gets in touch with when he forgets things about Westeros. Isn't that right?
That is true. He's called us maesters and his archmaesters before. We run Westeros.org, which is sort of the oldest, largest sort of fan site for the books. And we have, from that, we ended up working with George. We wrote The World of Ice and Fire in 2014, and we are soon having another book coming out, which is very relevant to this particular series.
So I can see it in the background for those that are watching on, yeah, on the YouTube channel, The Rise of the Dragon. Is that what it's called?
That is correct. It's sort of a heavily illustrated companion to The World of Ice and Fire, which is very much taking the text of Fire and Blood, which is what the show is based on, and making it a bit more concise for people who thought, you know, 700 pages of history were a bit too much for them, and they wanted, you know, more art with a lot more blood and violence and dragons, lots and lots of dragons.
That brings us neatly into, I guess, what we should tackle first. You know, there are going to be a lot of people that read and pored over every single page of every single book and are slavishly waiting for the next one. It seems as though you hijacked George's word processor whilst and stopped him from finishing the bloody things to do The Rise of the Dragon with him. And there are others who were more casual viewers of the show, knew that the books existed, but didn't really kind of venture into that land. And, you know, for many, many, many reasons. But it's rare that we get to kind of start a Game of Thrones adventure from a completely blank slate. Are we at a blank slate, though, or is this based on something that already exists, that people already know what happens?
It's a good question. Obviously, Fire and Blood is a book that George wrote, in part because of The World of Ice and Fire, where he created the Targaryen history, and it was so big that we couldn't put it all into the World of Ice and Fire. And then he published Fire and Blood. But a lot of people don't really know about it. However, there have been references to the history of the Targaryens in Game of Thrones, and in fact, some very specific references to the future events of House of Dragons in certain episodes of Game of Thrones, where, in fact, technically, if you've watched Game of Thrones, you've already been spoiled by how
Joffrey spoiled you. Of all the people, Joffrey has spoiled you if you watched Game of Thrones.
It would be that little It would be that little
It would be, wouldn't it?
What, I mean, I guess, are they even spoilers? If, you know, I think we can probably delve into those, can't we? What do we already know? I mean, we know about the Mad King. We knew that the Targaryens were in power for a long, 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 long time. We knew that there were tons of dragons. We all knew that it went horribly, horribly wrong at some point. But aside from that, I guess we're talking about throwaway lines or kind of things that were casually mentioned. Right. Chris, are you aware of these? Do you know what Elio and Linda are going to divulge?
I have a passing knowledge of the Dance of the Dragons, which is the event that I understand forms a lot of the events of this series. I sort of know the rough outcome. I wouldn't say I could tell you like in what order things go down, but it's such a, I considered getting into the material before the show, because I really enjoyed having read the books before watching Game of Thrones. Like, I really loved having a slightly extra layer of understanding of what was going on and sometimes what was left off the screen. And I haven't done that this time because it was a little bit intimidating. So I don't really know. I just know that the Targaryens, it's like a civil war between different factions of the families, and it doesn't end well for anyone. But is that accurate?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's fair to say that, you know, civil wars rarely come out nice and neat. So, you know, that's sort of what one can be expecting in the sort of the large scale, that nasty and brutish.
So what was the thing that Joffrey gave away then?
Oh, well, he kind of tells us the fate of one of the major protagonists or antagonists.
Oh, okay. Let's not
touch that. Yeah. But basically, it's kind of funny, but basically it's a throwaway line there. But it's a lot of things, like, you know, people were concerned about Game of Thrones and how going past the books would ruin it for people who are waiting for the books. And I've always been, and I think it's the same in this, it's the journey that matters. It's the, how you get to this point. It's one thing to hear so-and-so kills so-and-so. It's quite another to see how and why it happens. And this is what House of the Dragon is going to give viewers who are familiar with the material and who aren't familiar with the material.
I mean, you can watch a history movie that's, you know, based on a historical event. And you know that Caesar is going to get very stabbed at the end if you're watching something about, you know, Caesar's rise to power in Rome. Most people know that it's not going to end that well for Caesar. But you can still really enjoy watching what somebody does with the story.
No, for sure. And I think, you know, that's, I think that's what a lot of Game of Thrones book fans are waiting for the book. Obviously, the TV series, you know, split in the fork in the roads they left towards the end. The fabled has it. Now, I don't want to dwell on Game of Thrones too much because we're in a new dawn, but, you know, legend has it, George sat down with Daniel and David at the very early days and said, here's the end point. How you get there, that can be pretty fluid. But, you know, we can assume that even in George's mind, Bran was the Bran was on the throne. John ended up in, you know, just sodding off to the wilderness again. You know, all of those things we can assume. So I agree with you. The journey is how we get there. Right, let's set the universe, because prequels are really tricky to kind of set. We remember Westeros as being kind of ashes, really. The last time we saw it, it was rubble. It was, you know, King's Landing pretty much was gone. There was just a white horse kind of charging around, if I remember last time. And prequels have a tendency to kind of go, this was before. You know, I'm thinking of the Star Wars prequels when we were used to dirty, knackered old Jedis, and then all of a sudden we were in this opulent kind of like story about taxation. What's the universe like in Westeros in House of the Dragon?
Well, at this point in time, Westeros has seen unprecedented levels of peace and prosperity. It is actually, really, it is the high point of the Targaryen dynasty. So it is a very opulent time. It's a very potentially decadent time. And it's a time full of colorful figures and, you know, grand tournaments and balls. And
lots and lots of dragons.
And lots and lots of dragons.
When we say lots and lots, I can't picture in my head, you know, because they're so big. You know, we know Daenerys had three and she struggled to kind of, well, she didn't keep all of them in the end, but, you know.
I think the count of live dragons at the point where House of the Dragon starts is 17. Not all of them are adults, but I think that was the count that somebody gave, at least.
Maybe not at the start of House of Dragon, because it starts a little earlier.
That's true. Some of them are born later.
But a lot of dragons.
The peak is 17, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. I was like, is it going to be hundreds? Is it going to be 10? Okay. See, now I'm just thinking of kind of like a gory version of How to Train Your Dragon, which probably isn't what they're aiming for. So.
Well,
you never know. What about the wider area? So we know that Dragonstone, does that come into being in House of the Dragon? Do they arrive or do we kind of land in the thick of the Targaryen rule?
Very much in the thick of it. Dragonstone has, I mean, they found themselves there about 100 years before Aegon and his sisters conquered it, which is about 300 years prior to Game of Thrones or 200 years prior to House of a Dragon. So Dragonstone is the seat of the heir.
More like 130 years prior to House of the Dragon.
Chris. Yes. Look at that.
So good.
Well, actually, it's technically 107. But anyways, it gets very confused with all this. But yeah. In any case, the fact is that it is, the HBO uses 200 years. It's approximately 200 years. So if you've got to round up, right?
Yeah.
So it's the seat of the heir to the Iron Throne. But the king at this time is Viserys, the first of his name, who in Fire and Blood, he's described as a bit portly, a very jolly fellow who loved his feasts, who loved his tournaments, who loved his, you know, dances and masquerades. And he's someone who ends up finding that running the Seven Kingdoms isn't just a big party all the time.
Okay. And what else is happening in the world of Westeros then? We know the wall was built, I guess, thousands and thousands of years before that. The wall presumably exists. It's a known thing. Is that right?
Absolutely. The Night's Watch exists. They've existed for thousands of years, and they're just sitting there waiting for, by this point in time, you know, there's legends of, you know, the long night when these others, these White Walkers came down. But at this point, people think they're gone. They've been dead, as far as anyone knows, for thousands of years. And it's, you know, just the occasional wildling raid that they fend off. It's no one really cares about the Night's Watch very much at this point in time.
Although it should be said that in the prior king's reign, he and his queen, Daenerys, the old king, and his queen, Alysanne, actually visited the wall, and she went flying to look at it on her dragon. So the Targaryens haven't, at least in relatively recent memory, not completely forgotten about it. They did give them the wall some support at that point. But overall, yes, it's not something that is in everybody's mind all the time, certainly.
Okay. And what about overseas? Essos and all of those kind of places, are they kind of in contact with Westeros at this point? What's the deal?
Absolutely. There's all sorts of trades contact between them, of course. This is a very interesting period where House of Dragons starts up, however, because there's an alliance starts forming between several of the Free Cities, which causes problems in, you know, the narrow sea that divides Westeros from Essos. Problems that will have an effect, I think, on events in House of a Dragon.
Also, an important point to note is that Dorne is not yet a part of the Seven Kingdoms.
They have
not been brought in. So they are actually a separate kingdom. And while Aegon and his sisters attempted to conquer them and bring them into the realm, they managed to resist. And right now there have not been any further attempts to bring them under Targaryen rule. So while they claim it in their title that they are rulers of the Rhoynar as well, that is not in fact true.
For those that aren't or have forgotten, Dorne was like in before the Iron Throne. Dorne was around way back yonder, 12,000 years. The first men crossed the land bridge from Essos to Dorne. Remind people of how we know Dorne from the Game of Thrones series.
Well, we were first introduced to Dorne via Prince Oberyn, the Red Viper, who came to find justice for his family in King's Landing and ended up championing Tyrion and fighting a single combat against the Mountain, which didn't go so well. And then things went rather poorly in Dorne in general as his lover, Ilaria, took over things later on, killed off the rest of the family other than her daughters, and then they all ended up dying in the conflict with Cersei and the Iron Throne.
It's the hot place that was responsible for the sand snakes.
Yes. Yeah. That's another way of putting it.
Chris, is there anything from that tantalizes you at this point? We're entering a kind of like a new world. It kind of feels familiar, but feels fresh as well, right?
Yeah. I think that the really exciting thing for me is seeing geographically, like, Westeros will look very different to how it does on Game of Thrones. Like, not only because it's set so long ago, but like different families, maybe not in different seats of power. Or the one thing I keep thinking of is Harrenhal, which was in Game of Thrones was a sort of destroyed, cursed castle. My immediate thought is that around in House of the Dragon, and is that being ruled by someone? And like, it, you know, can Elio and Linda sort of shed a bit of light on that for us?
Harrenhal, you know, it was ruined when Aegon and his sisters conquered the Seven Kingdoms. Aegon burned it turned into slag. But there is a lord at this time who may actually appear on House of a Dragon. But it's still pretty ruinous because it's such an enormous castle. And actually, it sort of plays a very important role in how Viserys ends up becoming king. My understanding is that from what we've seen is that the show, from the trailers, the show will actually open at Harrenhal. So you will definitely get to see it.
Ah.
Oh, yeah. I think that's one of the things I think is quite exciting, is that Westeros and the whole universe is such a beautifully rendered thing on the show. And the opportunity to see it in such a different period, even down to the if that impacts the way that people dress, the way that the castles or the settlements are depicted. I just think that's when you really know that it's not the show we have watched previously, that it's like a completely new era or a previous era. And I think that's really exciting. That's definitely something that I'm looking forward to. And I think The Throne is also way...
supercharged.
Way different this time. It's a little bit more like how it is in the books, where it's sort of gigantic, which I think is quite exciting.
Yeah, I sat on it 2 days ago.
Oh.
I thought you looked like you were in a little bit of pain today, still.
Well, you know what? It's a lot comfier than the one they had for Game of Thrones. Whoever molded this one has done a much better job. But yeah, there's a lot more. We've seen the pictures of it in the trailer. There are now swords coming up from the ground around it. It's a lot higher. There seems to be like extra levels to the throne. I guess presumably we'll find out what happens to all of those, because we know that they don't stick around. They don't stay like that, right? But this is the original Iron Throne that we're seeing now, is it?
Yeah, that's correct. Obviously, George's, what he always wanted, I mean, it's a good attempt to try and capture more of what the throne should be like, but the real throne in George's imagination, as he writes it, he called it a monstrously huge thing. And we finally got an artist for World Rise of Fire, Mark Simonetti, who managed to depict it in close consultation with George. And he kept sending drafts to George. George's like, more swords, more swords. It's huge. It's probably 20 feet tall, but it's completely impractical for a Hollywood production. They mentioned this. They would have loved to have managed it, but they can't have this massive thing in the set and try and, you know, have a dolly for the camera showing the king way up above everyone else. So they probably have
actors falling down from it. You know,
dangerous.
Damn, we have to get a new one for the king because he fell down and he broke his neck. And, yeah, so that wouldn't be very good. But I think this is a really good compromise of taking the more basic version that they did for Game of Thrones, because obviously it's become so iconic for people, and then trying to make it a little bit more monstrous by over the top by adding the swords around it and bulking it up like that so that it looks more intimidating.
It does look very intimidating. Chris, before we move on, we're going to move on to talk about the producers and the TV show and the casts and the characters and all that kind of stuff. But Chris, how are you feeling about it? You know, we've spoken a few times in the run up to this, and I think you share a sentiment that probably isn't that unusual, actually, that a lot of people are quite nervous about the show. I think we're excited to see it, but also quite nervous, right?
Yeah, I think prequels are very hard. I think a prequel or any follow-up to one of the most, one of the biggest shows in the modern pop culture, I think following that up is very hard. I think the expectations are really hard. So there's definitely a sort of unease is maybe the wrong word, but like a sense of like, how are you going to pull this off? Because it's a lot hanging in the balance. Having said that, having watched the trailers have dropped quite late, I think, for a TV show that is like a big legacy media show. And it's only recently that there's been a new trailer, maybe a week ago or maybe a little bit longer. And I've been rewatching that, and all the excitement is there. Like seeing like just the dragons swooping along, seeing the characters, we're getting a lot more information the closer we're getting to the premiere date. And I think that is what's kind of starting to reassure me that it just looks sensational. And, you know, I remember when the first, second series of Game of Thrones came out, you know, it was done on quite a budget, really. It was restrained and it's grown in terms of budget. This feels like they're attacking House of the Dragon with like season 8 money.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks amazing. And I think watching it for me, like I'm just like, I think it's been such a good year for television generally. Even last year, it's been great, but there's been nothing like this. There's been nothing on this scale. And I just know like it's going to sort of take over my life for the next 6-7 years. So, you know, I'm kind of fully in now, but I think, yeah, it definitely was a sense of cautious kind of, how is this going to work? Or, you know, it doesn't feel like that long at all. So to come roaring back quite literally with something this polished, with, I think the casting in it is outstanding. It just feels like they could have pulled off the impossible, maybe.
Yeah, I think you're possibly right. We'll move on to, we'll talk about the characters in a sec. But, you know, you mentioned there, you know, prequels are really difficult to get right. And the makers, you know, HBO and whatnot have been able to learn from a lot of mistakes. Not their own, but, you know, prequels in general, there's been more bad ones than there have been good ones. You know, I asked people online on Twitter who follow DragonCast_part, just said, you know, what are good examples of that? And, you know, I think mainly because I think Better Call Saul finishes on Monday. It's its final episode on Monday. That's quite fresh in mind. That's a great example of how right you can get it when you do it properly. Because Better Call Saul doesn't even feel like a, it feels like a companion to Breaking Bad, but it, you know, it's been a masterclass of how you interweave timelines like that. And I don't think we need to worry about House of Dragon. We don't need to worry about baby Daenerys being born quite yet. But we'll be here in 10 years time waiting for Daenerys to be born, I guarantee it. But you know, Godfather Part 2 was like a sequel and a prequel at the time. Stephen East has said that, and maybe I'm related to him. Is he rich? Mark Thomas said Better Call Saul, and Ed Foster made a good point. The Star Wars prequels were universally kind of panned, and I think, you know, Attack of the Clones probably still can get in the sea, but there's now a lot of affection for Phantom Menace and for
Revenge of the Sith.
It was Revenge of the Sith, wasn't it? Yeah. You know, I have the high ground, Anakin, is now classed as a bit of an iconic line. But they said they learned from their mistakes of that and then created Rogue One, which is an incredible kind of prologue to A New Hope. It feels like they've chosen the timeline really well here, because they by choosing something that is so far before Daenerys and Tyrion and the characters that we love, they don't have to worry about how, from a script writing point of view, they weave all of that in. And they could have done the Night's Watch 50 years before, and it would have been a nightmare because it would have just been too complicated. Do you think that was in their minds? Do you think that's why they chose this era? Apart from the fact that everybody on social media just says, we just want more dragons. Elio and Linda, what do you think to that? Was it quite a calculated?
Well, obviously they tossed around a lot of ideas, and initially the pilot that they filmed was going much further back. And it seems to me that they felt that the connection was too tenuous. There wasn't enough in it that felt like Game of Thrones at all. And there was too much of a blank slate.
For those that don't know, there was a pilot made by HBO, which was set in the era of the creation of the Children of the Forest, right? It was, you know, very, very, like you say, very far removed from that. And it didn't see the light of day. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, so I think that they tested that. And then they had all these other pitches, which had various levels of material from George, and B, various degrees of connection to Game of Thrones. And the fact that they then landed on the Dance of the Dragon as the main event in the history that they wanted to portray, I think George had a lot to do with it. This was the one that George championed the most, I think, and felt the most that it is a story that very much connects to the whole Targaryen history, but it also stands on its own as a large event, a pivotal moment in the history with lots of inter-character drama and still a contained story. I mean, it's a huge story in some ways because of the, you know, the effects that are going to be needed with all the dragons involved. But it is still a relatively contained story space-wise. We're not going to be following people flung out all over Westeros and Essos in the same way that Game of Thrones did.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Right, we're going to take a quick break now. And when we come back, we're going to delve into the TV side of it and work out who's playing what wigs they're wearing and who's filming all the stunts. We'll be back right after this.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to Dragoncast, episode one of Dragoncast, brand new podcast by me, Jamie East, joined by Chris Mandel, Knight of Little Pinky of the King, and Elio and Linda.
I hate that nick. We're gonna have to sort a nickname out before next week.
It sounds like a penis, doesn't it? Let's be honest. We'll change that for next week. And Elio and Linda from Westeros.org, they're the insiders. They could literally text George R. Martin now if they wanted to. He probably doesn't even... Does he text? Does George R. Martin text? I can't imagine he does.
He texts, but we email him mostly.
Fine. Yeah. And someone prints it out, someone ties it to a raven and sends it to him in his wolf sanctuary. Yeah. That's how he answered it. Right. Okay, so... We've given people a bit of the history of the universe of Westeros and where we are in the grand scheme of things. Let's talk now about how they've brought it onto the screen. Those who may or not know, Daniel and David, who are the showrunners of the original Game of Thrones, whose vision it was, you know, to bring this whole thing to life originally, are no longer attached to it. I would imagine they're quite relieved about that. At this point in their lives, they're glad not to have to worry about taking on this legacy. But the people that have taken that on are people that if you've watched all the TV shows, you'll be familiar with Miguel Sapochnik, who directed arguably or even unarguably some of the best episodes of Game of Thrones, or certainly the most memorable ones. Hard Home, which was the episode where we first really saw the Night King's power, and he gave it the big come on brother to Jon on the shore. Battle of the Bastards and The Long Night, all three of those still give me goosebumps whenever I need a cheer. Well, maybe not cheer up, but whenever I need to kind of like feel good, I go and watch those episodes. So Miguel directed those. He's directing a few of these episodes, but he's kind of like the daddy of this now. And then we've got Ryan Condal. He's also an experienced showrunner and an Ice and Fire super fan as well. We're in safe hands with these guys, right? Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really without any shade intended to the people behind Game of Thrones. I think it's a great idea to bring new people in at the helm to run this, because I think we talked before the break about prequels. I think the worst thing you can do is try and recreate what you're a prequel to. So I think this should feel different to Game of Thrones, but have a lot of the same aesthetics and a lot of the same identity. And I think having someone like Miguel, who's directed the really meaty, cinematic, beautiful, and intense episodes, is a great idea. I think Ryan is also someone that, like, George R. R. Martin is very fond of in terms of his understanding of, like, lore, but also what the books are and what they're trying to say. So I think I'm really interested in what they do differently. I'd be really interested in how they can make House of the Dragon sort of look and feel different to Game of Thrones while also sort of threading it with a lot of the same things. But I think it's really cool. It feels like the biggest fans and the most talented people from Game of Thrones are kind of front and center, which is like, what more could you ask for?
Yeah. What do you think, Elio and Linda?
I think it's great. Miguel, you know, Hardhome was an amazing episode. He's done a lot of other things that I've seen. That's all really good. And I know that he actually first worked with Ryan Condal on a pitch for a Conan the Barbarian TV series. And actually, Condal is not just a super fan of Ice and Fire. He's a super fan of the genre in general and you know, the Hollywood movies. In fact, he, like you, Jamie, he is a podcaster, which I've been listening to his podcast about collecting props, and it's really fascinating.
I thought you were going to tell me it's about House of the Dragon for a minute. I thought I was in real trouble.
No. He has a podcast with another writer called The Stuff That Dreams Are Made Of, which is all about they're collecting Hollywood movie props, and they love the classic, you know, films. They love Aliens and Blade Runner and Star Wars. So it's all, you know, all in our wheelhouse. So I've enjoyed that. So I just listening to him, and he's dropped some hints about things he's been working on House of a Dragon, the things he cares about. He has a lot of passion for it. And I am very much looking forward to how it comes out on the screen. Certainly bits of a trailer have really captured my imagination. Like, there's clearly a big tournament in the show. We see some of the action in those trailers, and I think back to Game of Thrones, that first season where no one knew. David and Dan had not run shows before. They were brand new to it, and HBO had given them all this trust and a certain amount of money. And I remember them telling me afterwards, like, you know, we ran out of money. We couldn't do the whole tournament. So we had bad weather, and so we had to kind of find some way to cut it short. And it became a very small tournament. So seeing finally this really big tournament is going to be really cool.
And what kind of, I mean, do dragons take part in the tournament, or is it more traditional swords? And because that would be a very short tournament. wouldn't it, really? It'd be quite chaotic.
It would have been a very short tournament. No, it is the style that we are used to from, you know, A Knight's Tale and what have you, with knights riding at each other in the lists. And right. It seems occasionally getting into each other with the swords as well and so on. So it is a proper medieval tournament, not on Dragonback. That would have been an interesting version with, you know, knights going at each other on Dragonback. Maybe that'll be something we'll see later on in the show.
Do you know, I mean, I don't know if anybody really knows, really, you know, Miguel's forte is the big set piece. It's the episode long battles, the stunts, the thousands of extras, the CGI. We can expect at least two or three of those things, right? What's EP9 going to be, for goodness sake, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's some major stuff that happens, I think, across the whole of the events that they're going to cover. Knock on wood, the second season hasn't been confirmed, but I think, you know, I assume it'll happen.
We wouldn't be here if we didn't think a second season was coming. What a waste of time that would be, right? Can you imagine if they cancelled this? Just said, actually, no, we're done. No, actually, we're tired now. No, goodness me. You know, we mentioned it before, the money is all on the screen this time around. Chris, you talked about it. You know, you look back to the first episode of season one of Game of Thrones and Jaime's wig, and, you know, it's all pretty. It's Cersei and Jaime going at it in the tower with all the hay. It just looks like some. It looks like. Do you know? Remember the touring theater at the end of Game, like in the latter season of Game of Thrones. That's what the first seasons just look like all the time, right?
Yeah.
Tyrion's hair looked like he just stepped out of a salon.
They made him blonde, didn't they? He was blonde at first.
And the big one for me is the hunt, that they didn't have the money for the hunt. So it's like, it's a Monty Python version of the hunt where the guys are,
exactly.
They've almost got the coconuts for the horses because they're walking in the woods going hunting with the king. And it's just about time to bring in the coconuts. So no, it's quite clear that this is, as you said, this season 8 money from the get-go by the looks of it. And it's going to capture the scale of Westeros right from the start. And we'll see it not just at a point where it's a full-on war, basically. We'll see the scale of what the money can buy you in peacetime, so to speak. We will have the dragons out and flying with the riders. We will have this great tournament, and there will be various conflicts and such to sort out, even in the first season, that should look fantastic because of the direction and the money.
Do you think they're going to be able to, Chris, do you think they're going to be able to maintain the level of political intrigue and betrayal and shock that we've come to expect? You know, people are going to be watching episode 9 of season 1 of House of the Dragon going, this is the one. This is the one. Who's going to get it? You know,
any minute now. Yeah, well, I think that's just before I answer that question, I do think when I mentioned earlier, like, I hope they sort of don't stick to the script too much. I really hope they aren't like, episode 9's the big cliffhanger, guys. But in terms of, I think there's going to be so much intrigue, because what I understand, and bear in mind, I understand a lot less than Ellie and Linda here, but what I understand is this is one family collapsing from the inside. And I think that is just a slightly different way of thinking about this political intrigue. It's still the same idea that people want the throne. There are people vying for power and there are different factions, but I feel like we're exposing this from a very different angle. And yeah, I think there's a lot to explore, because I think it's all these people that are inherently part of one identity, one house, Targaryens. What does it mean to be a Targaryen? What does it mean to rule? And that's always been a sort of central theme in this show. And I think rather than having different families vying for it, you've got this central tenet that is not in agreement on what who should rule. I think the thing about Game of Thrones is, like, the show ran the full gamut, all the scheming, all the manipulation. But I mean, if there's this much material to do a show off, then I feel like we almost maybe haven't seen anything yet in terms of what people will do. You know, we know it ends horrifically, so I can only assume there's a lot of chaos ready to unfold.
Well, this is it. I mean, the one thing that we do know about Targaryens, even those that have only watched a few episodes of Game of Thrones, Targaryens are mental. they're just mental. And now we've got a whole season where they're all in charge and they're rich and they've got castles and dragons and soldiers. And, you know, that alone is pretty tantalizing, right? It's ripe for high drama. Okay, let's discuss the characters in House of the Dragon and who they've got to play them. Elio and Linda, tell us in as succinct as a way as you can, to those that don't know, we'll start at the top. King Viserys Targaryen. Who hell he?
He is the fifth Targaryen king to rule over seven kingdoms. He is the grandson of Jaehaerys, the old king who brought 50 years of peace and plenty to the Seven Kingdoms, and he loves to party.
He loves to party, brilliant, excellent. And he is played by, Chris, he's played by Paddy Considine.
We've got Paddy Considine playing King Viserys Targaryen. I mean, he is one of the finest actors we've produced. I think he's absolutely brilliant. I loved him in Journeyman, he was amazing in that. He's just such an amazing person to anchor this show. I think he's got the sort of, he feels like a combination of like Mark Addy and Sean Bean in terms of he's quite grave, but also I think has a really fun side to him. And he's just a legendary actor. And I think having him kind of helm the series, or the first series at least, I mean, I assume like he starts, he's the king. Can't imagine he lasts for long. That's just my theory. That just feels like a really exciting point to start the show off, having a legendary actor.
100%. Yeah, 100%. Couldn't agree more. Okay, next up, we've got Daemon Targaryen. Linda, who hell he?
Oh, he's a very colourful figure. He is the brother of King Viserys, and he is someone who's going to be, I think, a very strong, forceful personality on the show, because he's, George has said he's his favourite Targaryen, and that means he is extra everything.
And he is played by someone very familiar to British TV fans, Wibbly Wobbly Time Lord, Chris.
Yeah, Matt Smith is playing him, which I think, again, is just the most inspired casting. Like, if you want to know, if you want to have faith in what this is, you've got Paddy Considine and Matt Smith playing brothers, very different. I just think Matt Smith, apart from his recent stint in Morbius, is an absolutely brilliant actor, and he always chooses his projects very carefully. And I think having him as this charming, scheming, nefarious, handsome, swashbuckling kind of dragon riding super hunk is just inspired. So yeah, I can't wait for that.
I have to agree. I saw the trailer, you know, when I think the early photos of him on the beach shot down in Cornwall in England came out. It's like, oh wow, okay, this looks pretty cool. But when the trailer comes out, we'll beep this, but I was like, my god, he looks like a right and I love it.
He's actually called the Rogue Prince in one of the bits that George has written about him. And Daemon reminds me of that line about Lord Byron. He's mad, bad, and dangerous to know.
Yes, that's what we want from Doctor Who. Fantastic. And a bit of behind the scenes for everybody. When I did my Thronecast Wisdoms a couple of weeks ago, I had to talk about all the Targaryens. And for some reason, I could not get this name right. First of all, it was Rhaenyra, Rhaenyro, you know, is it Rhaenyra, right? Rhaenyra Targaryen. Elio and Linda, the first lady of House of the Dragon that we're going to meet. Who is she?
She is the daughter of Viserys. She is, in fact, the only child of Viserys at this point in time. And there is a big question mark about that, whether in Westeros, Westeros is very misogynist, very sexist, and people are kind of questioning, can she really be queen? So, in fact, for when I think the show starts, in fact, the heir to the throne is the king's brother, Daemon. But there may be questions about that as the show progresses.
Okay. And Chris, for reasons that we'll go into now, there are two actors playing Rhaenyra.
Yeah, this is something that Game of Thrones didn't really do until later on, but there are flashbacks. So we're getting characters in different stages of their lives. Emma Darcy is playing Rhaenyra as an adult. Emma identifies as non-binary and uses they, them, whereas the character is female. And Millie Alcock is playing a young Rhaenyra. Now, I don't know a lot about Emma Darcy, but all the promo leading up to the show, Emma just comes across like a total rock star. And I feel like Emma is going to be the breakout star of this first season. I think
just bold claims off a trailer.
Everything they embody, just honestly, like, I just get this amazing energy from seeing them on the red carpets, doing interviews, doing press. And I just think it's a really exciting, we've sort of had this in Game of Thrones, women born into a very male-dominated system, trying to carve out space for themselves. But I think this could be a really exciting addition to that sort of storyline. I'm just really excited to see where it goes.
So, Elliot, on the time jumps, what eras are we spanning? Presumably, we jump. Do we jump back or jump ahead? Which is present day Rhaenyra, do we know?
I guess present day, the bulk of the show, it's going to be Emma D'Arcy. But my understanding, again, is that the start of the show, and for the first, I don't know how many episodes, it'll be the young actress playing the younger version of Rhaenyra.
Got you. Okay, fine. And it's safe to say, I think, you know, intentionally or unintentionally, any criticism that was thrown at the original Game of Thrones was its portrayal of women, was its portrayal of a few things, that it would be fair to say that House of the Dragon has made great gains in trying to put right. Would that be fair to say, do we think? I mean, the storyline of, you know, with Rhaenyra's not being the natural heir to the throne feels very modern day, that we're tackling these kind of issues. Elliot Olinda?
Yeah, it's very true. Actually, I'm thinking of Matt Smith and The Crown, of course. He was Philip in that, and that has some resonance. But certainly, you know, when George took the material for Dance of Dragons, he turned it into a short story. And that short story focused the Dance of Dragons on the princess and the queen, is the title of that story. And so that really tells you the women are very central to the Dance of the Dragons. Mm-hmm.
Brilliant. And now here's a couple of names or a family that the viewers of the TV show will have no clue. If you're like me, you'd be like, wasn't this the really big policeman in Police Academy? But Otto Hightower is Hand of the King. Now, Hightowers, I've not read the books, as you guys know. I wasn't allowed to. And I still haven't read the books because who's got the time for that at the moment? But Hightowers, where were these in Game of Thrones?
Well, they are an ancient family. So they've been in Westeros for ages. So they were absolutely around in the timeline of Game of Thrones. They were a storyline and characters that did not end up featuring in the stories that were portrayed on the TV show. But they were definitely there. They are their seat, the Hightower, is in Oldtown, which is the second largest city in Westeros. So it's a very important place. That is also where the Citadel is, where the Maesters go to learn, and it's also important for the Faith of the Seven. So they are very significant, very influential, very rich, and they have a much bigger role to play, politically speaking, at this time period.
Okay, and Otto is the Hand of King Viserys, right?
That's correct, right. Yeah.
Perfect. So he's like, you know, if we're going to draw comparisons to people that want those comparisons to the TV, Otto Hightower is the Ned Stark to the King Robert, right?
That's right. Gotcha. That's right. Yeah. He's unlike Ned, he is a born
player of the Game of Thrones.
Yeah, he plays the Game of Thrones. He's ambitious and he's a very learned man. And he's very political.
Okay, great. So a lot less passive than Ned Stark, then, fair to say.
Yeah.
Great. And Chris, another British great.
Yeah, Risa fans, like, absolutely amazing. I just think this season is, the casting on it is incredible. I just think him and Paddy sort of bartering about what to do. I mean, it's kind of hard, isn't it? Because I don't have any idea what happens. I just know there's going to be a lot of fallings out about who's owed what. But yeah, I'm really intrigued because I remember the Hightowers from the books very vaguely. I knew that Old Tower was sort of where they were based. I couldn't remember if any of them had been in the books or if whatever. But I think it's really cool. I think it's really cool that the Hightowers and the Sea Snake, who we probably are about to talk about in a second, is going to be in the show, because these are very, like, legendary houses in Game of Thrones.
It was a new casting director this time around. Early, and I interviewed the casting of the original Game of Thrones. It was Nina Gold
who
discovered Kit Harington and, you know, yeah, and Emilia and all that kind of stuff. And now we've got someone called, according to IMDb anyway, we've got Kate Rhodes James, who I'm sure she would be devastated to know I'm not aware of her work. I don't know many casting directors worked, I have to say. She cast House of Gucci, Line of Duty, Raised by Wolves, the Ridley Scott one, not the Catelyn Moran one. She's got, yeah, she's done some good stuff. Bodyguard, Discovery of Witches. Oh, she's done tons. She's, my God, she's done a lot. I can't even scroll to the end of her IMDb. So in safe hands. But like you say, if you were casting House of the Dragon, very difficult to compare. But, you know, Nina Gold did a terrific job of spotting Maisie and all of that gang from Game of Thrones, for which was a completely unknown quantity and unknown title. Everyone was a bit sniffy because we'd just had Lord of the Rings. So it must have been tricky to cast that. I can't imagine there were that many no's thrown Kate's way this time round. I would imagine, I'm just calling about House of the... Yes. You know, that's how most of those must have gone, right?
Well, I believe Paddy Considine had said no to Game of Thrones, hadn't he?
It must have been, yeah.
I think that just he noted in an interview. So he got a second chance.
I think he would have been a good Littlefinger. Maybe a little bit too tall and rugged, but he could have been a good...
Maybe he was like a Ned Stark, but just considered too young, or he thought he was too young. You know, wasn't Pierce Brosnan offered James Bond, like, just before Timothy Dalton, but thought he was too young? You know, maybe it's a bit of that.
I think casting the younger characters is such an art, because when you cast someone like Maisie or Isaac, you're really also casting them for who they're going to be in 10 or 11 years' time. The casting on Game of Thrones is immaculate, and I think everything on this, as you said, the success of the show, who wouldn't want to be in HBO's flagship, like,
yeah,
show? But, yeah.
Who wouldn't want to be able to earn their pension from Comic-Con for the next 35 years?
And have an action figure made of you. I just one of my, like, long-time ambitions. That. I'd love that.
So Otto is Rhys Ifans, and then we've got, presumably, his daughter, Alicent Hightower. Is that right? Daughter?
Yeah.
What do we know about her?
So I'm not really sure if the show is doing this, but in Fire and Blood, she was brought by Otto during the reign of King Jaehaerys and his last years. He was the old king. He was very old. And he was, you know, getting a bit senile in his old age. And she would read to him and just be sort of a companion and a comfort to him. And I gather she sticks around, and her story gets a lot bigger than that as time goes by.
Okay, I love these ellipses we're getting at the end of Elio all the time. It's like, only time will tell. And again, we've got two actors playing Alicent. What do we know about them, Chris?
Yeah, so the older of the two is Olivia Cooke, who is a fantastic emerging British actress. I say emerging, she was in Ready Player One about 5 years ago, 4 years ago perhaps. But she was in Slow Horses recently in a slightly reduced role, I thought.
Such a great series, that.
Oh my God, it's so good. And she's in Sound of Metal as well.
Oh, amazing.
Really, I think she's long overdue, like, a massive role like this. And I think, again, when you cast someone like her, you know, as Elio implied, that this role is going to be quite a substantial one. And I think, yeah, the two families, the Targaryens and the Hightowers, both occupying parts of the inner circle in these different generations, I think there's a lot of potential there for very, yeah, thorny sort of conflicts. And yeah, I just think it's great. Another great one.
There is a little bit in this, isn't there, where it's like, okay, which actors are big enough to go, I'm not sticking around just for three episodes, mate. I'm in it for the long haul. Do you know what I mean? There's a little bit of that, right? Yeah. Although we all made that mistake with Sean Bean.
Yeah. Also, I just wanted to mention, I forgot to say, Emily Carey plays young Alicent.
Gotcha. Is she a newcomer? We don't know much about her, right?
I don't really know her. I'm not really familiar with her work. But I think Olivia for me, though, is like sort of looks a little bit like Marjorie Tyrell. Just very like classically beautiful, like very like Renaissance painting-y. But I think Slow Horses, she was like running around with a gun, like, you know, breaking into buildings. So right. I just think, smush those two things together and you've got like a good lead for this show.
Okay, this is a character I'm really excited to kind of find out about. It's the, I guess, the most visually striking from the trailer, and it's like, wow, this feels slightly progressive for Game of Thrones, but it also feels quite exciting. It's Corlys Velaryon, is that right? Have I pronounced that right? Please help me.
I've always said Velaryon. I don't know how we'll say it on the show, but...
Velaryon. I'm thinking of the steel, aren't I? That's Velaryon, where I'm going. Yeah.
I think they're saying Velaryon. So, Actually, yeah, from what I've heard.
Okay, but Corlys, is that correct?
Is correct,
is that the first name? This is the Sea Snake, who we know as the Sea Snake. If you watch the trailer, it's the awesome looking dude with the white dreadlocks. That's all you need to know. What do we know about the Sea Snake, Elio Anundo? Who is he?
Oh, he's an amazing character, actually. He is the greatest explorer of his age. He has famous for his 9 voyages across unknown parts. Yes. And then he married a Targaryen princess and is the has become the richest man in the Seven Kingdoms. He's richer than the Lannisters.
I like this guy. This guy's got everything. Yeah. Wow, okay, fine. Is he has he pledged an allegiance to any particular house, to any kind of, or is he kind of floating around Littlefinger styling?
Sure, he is, so he rules the Seat of Driftmark, and it is an island that's right next to Dragonstone. So officially he is sworn to the Targaryens, and his family have had a long association with the Targaryens. They've commanded the ships ever since Aegon the Conqueror landed. You know, it was a Valyrian who was commanding his fleet, and they have traditionally commanded the whole fleet of the Seven Kingdoms.
Amazing. So he sounds pretty well developed as a character. He looks great. What do we know about the guy that's playing him, Chris?
He's played by Steve Toussaint. I kind of know him from your sort of Sunday night ITV dramas, Line of Duty, Scott and Bailey, that sort of thing. Really excited to see how he fits into the larger picture. My understanding is that he is married to a Targaryen and they've got a huge fleet. And my association with like the seafaring people in Game of Thrones is the Ironborn, but this house sounds like the sort of classier version of the Ironborn, right? Like, would that be right? Or are they just as nefarious?
Much classier. That's absolutely true.
It's the royal fleet. Okay. They're much tidier.
They're middle class Ironborn.
Less Viking. I mean, they are, you know, there are knights of House Valyrian and so on. So they are very much in the main Westerosi culture.
Yeah. And I also had a question about this house, which is this house still around in Game of Thrones and in the Song of Ice and Fire books? Are they still around just in the background?
They are around. In fact, if you've read, you know, A Feast for Crows, the fourth book, a bastard of the family shows up and plays an important kind of role in things that happen in King's Landing. So yes, they are definitely around. They've been mentioned since the second book, but they, you know, for Game of Thrones, they just didn't bother having so many of these secondary houses or tertiary houses around.
Their bastards have the surname Waters, is that right?
That's correct.
Because they're sort of based on an island.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Be very cool.
Yeah. Love a bit of a swashbuckler as well. You know, I guess Prince Oberyn was the closest we had. But this guy sounds like a cross between Indiana Jones, the Jack Sparrow that it's still okay to like, and Magnum PI. He sounds great. Yeah. Now, let's move on to someone who I am like super, super excited to find out about and learn about, mainly because I'm such a big fan of the actress that's playing her. Princess Rhaenys Velaryon. Is that right, Rhaenys? Did I pronounce that right? I'm getting it all out now. So for the next 10 episodes, I get it right. This, I think, and I know nothing about it, but I get the sense that her character is going to be intrinsic to the implosion of what we're about to watch. Would that be fair to say? She seems to carry a lot of bitterness, Elio and Linda.
She does, and it's not for nothing. I mean, she's called the Queen Who Never Was. She was one of the people who could have inherited the Iron Throne at one point, but was passed over for a male heir. That was when they basically made the decision to look at, okay, can we have a female who's going to inherit Iron Throne? And that could have been Princess Rhaenys. It didn't happen, okay. So some people refer to her as the Queen Who Never Was, and she hasn't quite gotten over that.
So she's King Viserys's cousin.
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess then that, you know, the question around whether Rhaenyra is allowed to sit on the throne would rankle her greatly. It's like, well, how the fuck is she allowed on the thing if I wasn't, that kind of thing?
It's certainly, I mean, she wasn't just passed over once. Actually, she was passed over twice for the throne. So she definitely has that. But, you know, she did make a very good marriage with Corlys Velaryon, this wealthy, you know, influential, exciting figure. And there's one other thing. She has a dragon.
Okay, right. So just to clarify, she's the wife of the sea snake.
That is correct. Yes.
That's correct. Right. Okay, fine. And yeah, so you don't have to hand in your dragon if you lose the Targaryen surname.
No, and technically, actually, in the books, it's quite common to still refer to women of very prominent houses who marry. We tended to see Cersei referred to as Cersei Lannister, even though she was married to Robert Baratheon. So quite often Rhaenys is referred to as Rhaenys Targaryen, because that is the more prominent house of the two, and she sort of keeps that connection. It has a little bit of the pride thing. She's going to keep the more powerful name. And once you have a dragon, you have that dragon for life. It is a bond between dragon and rider. You don't have to hand in your dragon rider card.
Unless you're a Night King. you take whatever the hell you want. Brilliant. And tell us about Eve Best, please, Chris.
Well, my favourite Eve Best role is Wallis Simpson in The King's Speech. That's one of my favourite films. So I'm so excited. I have to say also, when they first started revealing the cast photos way back when, I didn't even recognise her. So I had a bit of a secondary like, oh shit, she's in this. This is amazing. She's just so cool. Ladbroke Grove, I think she was born. So, you know, a bit of West London represent. I just think also the way that they've got different houses working together and forming these like partnerships is just, I'm just excited thinking about it. And I think what it means to give up your name when you marry or retain it, or what does it mean if you identify as a Targaryen and it politically or otherwise, I think just gets me excited thinking about it. I think it's so much potential in this show because it's doing things similarly, but also very differently to Game of Thrones.
Absolutely. She was in I first saw her in Nurse Jackie. She played.
I never watched that.
Oh, Nurse Jackie's great. Oh, it was at the beginning anyway. Aren't they all? but interestingly enough, she seems to like have caught the eye of online as well. She's had lots of fan accounts created for her. I've noticed lots of Eve Best fans online, kind of like following me once I put up a picture of Thronecast and stuff. Yeah, so she's a popular choice, I think. But yeah, tantalizingly good. I think kind of Catelyn Stark-esque in terms of like feels like a character that we're gonna really admire is the wrong word, but really relate to, I guess, would be.
Yeah,
that's where I am at the moment. I'll probably change it all 5 minutes into episode one, but there we go. That's my prerogative. So Kristen Cole, who hell he, Elio and Linda, who's next on my list? We've got a couple more.
Yeah, Kristen Cole is a relatively poor knight. His father was a steward for a lord in the Dornish Marches, and I believe on the show they decided to clarify that he is actually of a Dornish descent or partially Dornish. The Dornish Marches border Dorne, and he is a knight who shows up at a tournament and turns out to be, surpassingly skilled. And he an ambitious young knight can have a big future in King's Landing.
Okay, so we don't know, he's as new to all of the characters in the House of the Dragon when we meet him, is he? Right, brilliant. I like all of that. And who's playing him? I don't recognise him, Chris. Tell me about him.
No, this is someone that listeners may not be that familiar with. It's Fabian Frankel.
Okay.
Relatively new name. What I will say, he has a relationship to Game of Thrones in some ways, because he was opposite Emilia Clarke in the 2019 film Last Christmas, which,
oh my god,
I
was he?
Love this film. Yeah, he's one of the guys that she like hooks up
with. Oh, he is, isn't he? Yes. Oh my god. Wow. Yeah.
I just want to say, I love this film so much, and everyone hated it when it came out. I know we're recording this in August, but Jamie, it's so good.
Chris, it's a sack of shit. It's a sack of shit, mate. Come on.
The thing is, though, if you move past that,
if you move past the fact that it's a sack of shit.
No, it's so good. It's so good. It's better if you know the twist, because you can stop thinking, oh, they're trying to make this a plot twist. Anyway, he was in that. It's going to be great in this. Justice for Last Christmas.
Is it too late to cancel this? I mean, one of the worst plot twists of the century, I would say.
Yeah, but like I said,
we have to watch that now.
It's quite rewarding at the end.
Watch it.
It's on Netflix.
Desecrated the legacy of George Michael. That's all I'm going to say.
Oh.
But yeah,
it is an absolute mess. It's an absolute mess of a film. But like, honestly,
it's got some endearing things into it. Well, let's hope Fabian can exercise those ghosts and then move on from that. And finally, on list of ones to watch for everyone listening is Missaria. I've just got one word. She's the Beyonce, she's the Madonna, she's the Adele, she's the Rylan of House of the Dragon. She's got just the one name. What do we know about Missaria?
Missaria is also a sort of character that's going to be unknown to a lot of the characters in House of the Dragon, but she got an association with Prince Daemon. And she's going to play a fairly significant part as we go on. But it's difficult to say that much about her without being spoilery, except that she's got a close connection to him, and she's a foreigner to Westeros. That's part of the reason that she's just got the one name. She doesn't have a family in Westeros, so she's a foreigner.
Okay, I'm gonna kind of go down to Ladbrokes. I'm gonna say she's a baddie. She's a baddie through and through. I'm looking at her cast picture. She's giving it the side eye. She's going, Targaryens, I'm going to fuck you up. That's what I'm getting from her. Am I warm or cold? Am I fire or ice?
Fire.
Yeah.
Yay! There we go.
The thing you've got to remember, though, that it is a civil war, so there's Targaryens on both sides.
True. This is true. And interestingly, also, she's in one of my favourite ever scenes put to cinema ever.
I know what that is.
Chris, can you guess what it is? Elio knows. Chris,
was she in Last Christmas as well?
No, she was the actress, however she wishes to present herself. How do you pronounce her name, Chris? I'm going to hand that one over to you.
It's Sonoya Mizuno. Yeah,
and she was in Ex Machina, which was the incredible Alex Garland, one of my favourite science fiction films of all time. And she was the woman that did the dance with Oscar Isaac, right?
That is correct.
That's right, yeah. She's also been in Maniac, Crazy Rich Asians, and she was in Annihilation as well. She's worked with Alex Garland a couple of times. Really exciting casting.
Oh, Annihilation, that was the weird kind of Netflix.
The one about the scientists. Yeah, well, it was supposed to be released by Paramount, but I think Netflix bought the distribution after it filmed. It was the one where it was like about these four scientists. Oscar Isaac was in it, and like it tested really badly, so they didn't know what to do with it, so they just sold it to Netflix. But it's brilliant.
It's quite trippy, isn't it? It's quite mushroomy. Yeah,
it's like weird, psychotic, assy. It's great. I would recommend. Yeah, really, really cool casting. Really intrigued. I mean, I have a cursory knowledge of like the source material that this show is set on. I know nothing about this character, so I'm really, really intrigued.
Fantastic. I mean, what a great list. We've been through so many of them. What I'm also excited about is that these are like the ones that are being presented to us as the main characters. What we don't yet know are the ones that we're going to fall in love with that we didn't know that we were going to fall in love with at Game of Thrones. I'm thinking about, you know, like Littlefinger became such a big part of our lives, you know, and yeah.
Queen of Thorns, great example, somebody comes in late.
All of those kind of like, not bit players, but just really, the Hound, you know, I don't think we've met our Hound this time around. So it's things like that, isn't it, that make this show so great, is that it's such an intrinsically and well-developed universe that everyone arrives fully formed and fully developed, and I can't wait. I cannot wait. Chris, what are you looking forward to? We're looking forward now to episode one, season one, episode one of House of the Dragon. We know a little bit from what we've garnered from Elio and Linda today. What are you hoping for?
What I'm most looking forward to is the discord, this sort of sense of chaos looming, because I think with Game of Thrones, there was this sense from the very start something was wrong. There was a sense that something was going to shift, some gears were shifting, there was some sort of embers that were going to spark. So I'm just really looking forward to seeing that moment when, from what we've been talking about today, it sounds like it's a fairly peaceful period in the kingdom and there's a sense of relative calm. I'm just looking forward to that first crack in the glass. To see that everything's going to go to shit.
Good phrase. And yeah, you picked up on something quite important there. It's one thing that I'm not sure we're going to get in House of the Dragon is that impending sense of doom that we had from, you know, winter is coming was such a wonderfully coined phrase. And like you say, the first shot of Game of Thrones season one was that kind of symmetrical shape of the body parts in the snow. Yeah. And you knew that there was something that just could not be stopped. There was this unstoppable force coming to kill everything in its sight. I'm presuming we don't have that kind of element in House of the Dragon. So this is very much a different kind of beast, and we're going to have to kind of like attach ourselves to a different path, right, Elio and Linda?
Yes, I mean, here we have more, the politics are not just the thing that is going to sort of be the distraction from the looming threat, which in the sense was the story of Game of Thrones, that everyone was focusing on trying to gain the Iron Throne, whereas this threat against the existence of mankind was looming over them. But here we're talking more about that the politics are the meat of the whole story, and we're looking at the impending doom of a family rather than of the whole kingdom. But obviously when you're talking about the ruling family, that can still upset the cart for a lot of people.
Amazing. Brilliant stuff. Listen, let's wrap this up. We've had a great episode. We've talked about so much now. And if we've done anything for any listeners or people watching on the YouTube channel, I'm now 10 times more excited to watch this show than I was an hour ago. I cannot wait. Elio and Linda, hopefully we can get you back at some point a bit later on in the series to kind of have a bit of catch up and see how you guys are getting on and how you're enjoying it. In the meantime, can you let listeners and viewers know how they can find out a bit more about you?
Sure. You can see us at our website at www.westeros.org. I'm also on Twitter as WesterosOrg altogether. And we have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Westeros.
Brilliant. Get all of your questions on to Elio and Linda on Twitter. They love it and they'll just answer them all. And Chris is going to be joining me every single week. Sorry about that, Chris.
Yeah, you didn't ask where people can find me. I'm just around most of the time. You'll be here.
Yeah. He's still allowed to join you every week despite the Christmas movie thing.
Yeah.
Well, we'll debate that. I mean, I'm going to speak to his agent.
I'm going to come round to Jamie's house and make him watch it.
Well, listen, thanks very much for listening, everybody, to this. I'm not going to say episode one. It feels like a bit of a prologue because we're going to be speaking after every single episode of season one of House of the Dragons. It's going to get published at the same time as Thronecast would have been published or would have been broadcast on Sky, which would be after the evening episode on Sky Atlantic of House of the Dragon. And just want to say a big shout out to all of my friends at Sky TV and Now for their help. And if you are in any way confused about where you can watch House of the Dragon and you're listening in the UK or Ireland, you go to sky.com and have a look there. All the details are on there. It's on demand. It'll be streaming. It'll be everywhere. You will not be able to escape it. We're back, baby. Westeros is back. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. Don't forget, House of the Dragon airs exclusively on Sky Atlantic at 2 a.m. every Monday, then repeats that same evening at 10. You can also get it on demand via Now. If you'd like to get involved in the podcast, just head over to Twitter at @DragonCast_pod or email DragonCast@daftdoris.com and leave us your Easter eggs, predictions and thoughts on the show. You can also watch this episode over on our YouTube channel. Just search for DragonCast Jamie East. Any support, whether it's a follow, a share, a mention to your friend on the bus or a tattoo on your backside, is very much appreciated. DragonCast is hosted by me, Jamie East, along with Chris Mandel, produced by Connor Driscoll, edited by Buddy Peace, and is a Daft Doris production. Dracarys.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.